This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We continue our coronavirus coverage today, and we invite you to join us throughout the hour with your questions. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. A little later in the hour, we'll hear from heads of two senior care facilities, and we'll have our daily panel of doctors who will take your coronavirus questions. But we want to start in Washington, where the focus is on the Senate and an almost $2 trillion stimulus package. The White House is still negotiating with senators on this third stimulus, but the majority leader says they're close. Joining us now from Washington is Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey. Welcome back, Senator.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
So, Senator Markey, how close is the Senate to an agreement on this stimulus bill, and what would it entail?
Well, we think we're moving towards a conclusion of the negotiation, hopefully by later on this evening. It will be completed. But again, no provision is completed until every provision is completed. So we're not at a point where we can say we have a final package yet.
Here's Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell today on the floor of the Senate.
At different times, we received Democrat counteroffers that demanded things like new emission standards or tax credits for solar panels. We saw the Speaker of the House release an encyclopedia of unrelated demands as though it were a coronavirus proposal somehow.
Senator Markey, that's after yesterday the majority leader excoriated Democrats, saying Dems were derailing the speedy process, potentially larding the legislation. What is your response to those comments?
Well, I think, again, what he excludes, of course, is the Republicans' desire to put $3 billion into this legislation in order to buy oil out of the strategic and put it in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve in order to drive up the price of oil at the gas pump in the United States right now, and to try to save oil companies, save natural gas companies. And so that's their idea. And so we said, well, we have wind and solar companies as well who will need some help. So it was all part of a negotiation where they were first asking on the oil industry. And by the way, in the original formulation of the slush fund, the $500 billion slush fund they wanted to construct, for 6 months, the American people would not have known who was receiving the money. And you can be sure that if Donald Trump was sitting alone in the Oval Office with $500 billion, we know that the oil industry, the coal industry, would be at the top of their list. So we were just looking to make sure that there's equity and transparency in the process. And now we think we're going to have an inspector general who is going to be a part of the overseeing this $500 billion program, and we'll also have almost immediate disclosure within a few days of who is receiving the money, so that the sunshine of public knowledge will be a disinfectant to make sure that we don't see corporate cronyism instill itself into that program, because there's a very real risk that that would happen.
If the sticky wickets on both sides were, at least in part, some of these larger expenditures where there's concern about whether it's appropriate in this package or whether there could be sufficient oversight, why not both parties pursue something significantly smaller and more targeted that you might be able to get done faster? How do we get to this kind of size and scope of legislation?
Well, we need something that's of this magnitude in order to keep our economy going, but also to deal with the incredibly negative impact this is going to have upon American families. Workers all across our country are going to be filing for unemployment insurance, so we had to make sure that we had an unemployment insurance program that was going to match the magnitude of that problem. And we fought hard as Democrats. It's much more generous than the Republicans had intended on putting in, but we had to get that done. We had to make sure that the funding was going to be sufficient to deal with the stress on hospitals, on community health centers, on nursing homes, on other healthcare facilities, which are going to be central for us to deal with this coronavirus crisis. And we had to fight hard in order to have a big number in this bill to make sure the hospitals are protected. So if you go down issue after issue, even the airline industry, well, on the one hand, we have to make sure that it's those companies stay solvent. On the other hand, we have to make sure that any money that we give them goes to ensure that workers aren't laid off, that we have protections for workers as well, which, of course, the Republicans forgot to build in when they gave us their proposal just on Saturday.
When you got the proposal, there were no provisions for workers in it when you originally got it on Saturday?
That's right. So it was our job then, once we saw the outlines of their proposal. And by the way, they did that without Democratic input. So the better way to have constructed the proposal they put out on Saturday was to already have had Democrats sitting at the table. You know, that Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer representing the Democrats were at the table. And, of course, that was not the case. And so the discussion really only began on Saturday and Sunday, and it's Tuesday. So we've worked hard to try to improve their proposal and to build in safeguards that will limit the likelihood that we're going to see this program be compromised in a way that doesn't protect taxpayers, workers, or families. And we've tried as best we can to accomplish that goal over the last 3 days.
I'd like to shift our focus for a minute to the Commonwealth here. Are you in contact with Governor Baker, and how do you think the state is handling the crisis?
Yeah, there's no question that we are right on the front lines and in communication with the state, but the hospitals are calling me each day, telling me of the dire straits they could be in. The Massachusetts nurses are letting me know the stress that our nurses are being put under in terms of the lack of protective gear. It's a crisis. It's hitting Massachusetts very hard. And the real concern is that because the president has yet to invoke the Defense Production Act to mobilize the production of all of the protective equipment, mobilize for the production of all the testing which we need, that it's going to complicate dramatically the ability of our medical system to be able to respond.
Today, the governor held a press conference at noon. He's been doing these daily. He said something of note about the Senate's deliberations.
The debate around the economic aid package in the Senate, well, frankly, it's been appalling. But I can't say I'm surprised. I've watched and seen governors and mayors and other elected officials completely shift their focus to the task at hand without the slightest partisan bend. So I know it's possible, if they choose to, for D.C. to do the same.
So I recognize that the House and the Senate are actually deliberative bodies, and that means they work differently than a governor or a mayor would. But what could be done differently in Congress right now to reach the kind of, I don't want to say harmony, but collaboration that Governor Baker is exhorting there and that he feels like he's seeing with his colleagues around the country?
Yeah, well, that was a problem. The Republican leaders of the Senate decided to try to do it in a partisan basis. We urged them right from the get-go to think of this as a pandemic that should have no partisanship in it. But the Republicans injected it. They decided to do their proposal alone. We would be much further along if they had included Democrats right from the beginning. So that's the big problem. And we've tried to correct it, But if we didn't stand up on Sunday and just say, no, we're not going to allow this to move until we're sure that there's enough unemployment insurance, which there wasn't, that workers are going to be protected. Those protections weren't there, that families are going to get what they need, which had not been included. We would have already completed it. But they decided, the Republicans, that they would try to jam this process, but without the safeguards, including, by the way, this $500 billion slush fund that would just be in the hands of Donald Trump without any safeguards built around what he would use it for, without any transparency, without any inspector general who would be able to ensure that there was no compromise of the integrity of that program. None of that was built in. So that's a shame. It could have been corrected if the Republicans had decided to start off you know, where they're going to wind up anyway, which is having to work with Democrats.
Senator Markey, going back to something you'd said earlier, you talked about wanting the president to begin using the Defense Production Act. FEMA Administrator Pete Gaynor told CNN today that the administration will start using the powers of the Defense Production Act for 60,000 test kits and, quote, use the allocation portion of the Defense Production Act starting today. Does that seem proportional, 60,000 test kits? And what's your reaction to the choice to use it for that purpose first and for that size and scope of an intervention?
Well, I called Vice President Pence last Tuesday night, and I had a conversation with him about the use of the Defense Production Act. I told him that according to our own federal Department of Health and Human Services, that we were going to need 3.5 billion masks. Billion mask in order to get through this crisis. Whenever the president now has press conferences, he talks about thousands of additional masks or millions of additional masks. No, we're talking billions.
Do you think the DPA should have been used for masks first before test kits, or is it all of the
piece? All of
just
it.
Trying
all
to
of
get
it.
A sense
for
from
ma-
you.
For masks, no, for masks, for test kits, for ventilators, for all of it. We should already be deep into the era where the president has made it clear to the private sector that he wants a prioritization of the manufacture of all of these critical tests, masks, ventilators that are central to our country being put on a war footing against coronavirus. He has yet to do it. And it's going to put our healthcare workers at risk. We're not going to have the radar system up, which is testing, to a degree where we have the capacity of testing asymptomatic patients who think they may be at risk, but we won't be able to do that because we're only going to have enough test kits to deal with people who are already sick and showing
their
symptoms.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we've only got about 20 seconds left. I'd love to get one thought from you for the people of Massachusetts.
Sure.
Please. What's your thought for the people of Massachusetts you'd like to share with them right now?
I'm down here as a legislative first responder working for you to try to get all the resources up to Massachusetts, which you're going to need for your families and for our healthcare system to respond. We need you to abide by all of the guidelines that have been laid out there by public health officials to social distance, to not leave your homes if you don't have to, and to wash your hands. We can beat this, but we're all in this together as one family, and if we do it, we can come out on the other side, but ultimately Massachusetts has to be the leader.
That is Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Senior care facilities have been severely restricting visitors, especially after the outbreak at the Life Care Center in Kirkland, Washington, where at least 129 people tested positive for the virus and 35 have passed away. Cases have been identified in several senior care facilities across Massachusetts. Do you live in or have loved ones in a senior care facility? What are they doing? Or are you an older adult taking precautions in your home? What are you most worried about? Call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. In a minute, we're going to talk with the heads of two senior care facilities and take those calls. But first, we want to check in with WBUR reporter Miriam Wasser. Hello, Miriam.
Hi, Tiziana.
So, Miriam, just a quick update. One death so far in a Massachusetts care facility of a 91-year-old resident. What do we know?
Yes. So we know that this man was a resident of Rogerson House, which is a memory care facility in Jamaica Plain. When I talked to someone from there this morning, they told me that the man had underlying health problems and went to the hospital on March 15th for reasons related to that. While he was there, he began having symptoms that were consistent with COVID-19, so was tested. Unfortunately, his situation started getting a lot worse, and he was put in end of life care treatment, where he died on Friday evening. And the next day, his test came back positive. And in addition to that, another resident of Rogerson House has tested positive and is being quarantined, and an employee who tested positive is recovering at home. We've also, as you mentioned, just seen positive cases from residents and employees at several other nursing homes and assisted living facilities in the state.
So to that point, what are the protocols right now, Miriam, at most senior care facilities here in the Commonwealth?
Yeah, well, I'm sure you'll hear a lot more about this in the next segment, but pretty much every facility has ramped up their cleaning schedule and they're screening everyone who comes into the building. For a couple weeks now, staff have had to have their temperature taken before they've come into the building, and a lot of people are wearing personal protective gear. I also know that a lot of long-term care facilities have been limiting or canceling group activities. Some places have suspended group dining and are delivering meals to people in their rooms. Others are just trying to increase the number of dining shifts or keep, you know, have groups of smaller people. And pretty much, you know, bottom line, to whatever extent possible, these facilities are trying to enforce social distancing. And that kind of brings us to outside visitors, which is a really tricky question for a lot of people because they have family and friends in here. Pretty much every facility that I've heard of, whether it's skilled nursing or assisted independent living, has limited visitors, including family members. And different places are handling this differently. Most have exceptions for end-of-life care patients. But it's gotten a lot of different reactions, as you can imagine.
So, Miriam, just briefly, you did a story recently about older adults who live alone. How are they dealing with this?
I did. So I interviewed my 87-year-old neighbor, Jane Poncia. She lives with her cat, Calico, in an apartment in East Boston. A week and a half ago when I talked to her, she was still grocery shopping and going out with friends. And here's what she told me about her situation.
And I don't know what else I can do short of putting up barriers in the door and not letting anyone in. And that would be extremely lonely. So I won't do that.
That was a week and a half ago, though. So these days, she's not really leaving the house. Her son is bringing her groceries, and she's spending a lot more time on the phone with her friends. Since the story aired, I've spoken with her a few times, and she's doing well. So I just want to say that. I also talked to a woman, 69-year-old Mary Flynn, who lives alone in Brewster. And she was talking to me about how she's remaining positive through all of this. Her strategy has really just been to take things day by day and fill her schedule with some fun and activities. So here's what she told me.
Once or twice a day, I go for a long walk. And I self-entertain really well. I mean, I can always turn on a rom-com. You know, I watched Notting Hill twice already.
Miriam, I'll have to go check out Notting Hill. It's been a long time.
Oh, it's a good movie.
All right, that's WBUR reporter Miriam Wasser. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Listeners, we've been covering the coronavirus for you for several weeks now and bringing you breaking news, medical answers every day with a panel. We're all beginning to understand the scope, breadth, and length of this new situation we're in. And we want to begin to have conversations about the longer-term implications and how we're experiencing day-to-day life. We thought today was a great day to focus on older adults and senior care and begin to explore those questions with you. We've had two wonderful senior care leaders agree to join us today. The first is Lou Wolf, president and CEO of Hebrew Senior Life, one of the largest senior care operators in Massachusetts. Lou, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Crystal Cote-Stowes, administrative director of Lathrop Home in Northampton. Lathrop Home is a residential care facility with 38 residents who range in age from 58 to 96 years old. Crystal, welcome.
Thank you.
And we have you, callers. What are your concerns about people that you love or care about who are in institutional or senior care now? What about older adults living alone? Are you living alone as an older adult? What are your worries? How are you handling the social separation that we're being asked for? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Lou and Crystal, I'd actually like to start with one of our calls. This is Leanne from Canton. Leanne, go ahead.
Hey, how are you? Just calling because my dad was recently placed into assisted living, and the hardest part is we can't see him. And he suffers from anxiety and depression. He's in a room all by himself, and it's heartbreaking, and it's one of the hardest parts of this coronavirus.
Crystal Cote-Stowes, what do you have to say to Leanne as somebody who's an administrative director in a senior care facility?
Leanne, I completely understand how you're feeling. We also have residents at the Lathrop Home who have anxiety and depression around not being able to have the daily contact that they're used to, that face-to-face contact with their loved ones. We do have family members that we are calling via FaceTime apps so that we can have the seniors in our facility at Lathrop Home see their loved one face-to-face, wave, blow kisses. We are also having programming in our facility. We have groups set up of less than 10 residents that we can social distance 6 feet apart, and that has been helping to keep our residents busy. The number one feedback that we've heard is that our residents feel safe and that they are protected. They refer to the Lathrop Home as being like their bubble of protection because we have nobody in our facility that is sick, and everybody is doing very, very well and has very good spirits.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join this conversation. Let's take one more call for now. Marilyn's on the line from Newton. Marilyn, go ahead.
Thank you. I live in a senior building in Newton, and they are doing everything in their power to help us and protect us. But there's one rule I find illogical, and that is people can come in who have been tested. And this means that all of the aides who come here say that they're tested, or maybe they bring a document, I don't know, and they come in. Residents, but other than that, you cannot have anyone. Residents can go out, however, and then come back in again. I don't understand the logic of this. If residents can go out, they can go anywhere and pick up the virus and then come back again. This is the rule that was given to the, as far as I know, the director of the building.
All right, Marilyn.
And I don't understand it.
I appreciate that, and I hear your frustration with that. Lou Wolf, you can hear Marilyn's frustration. It almost feels, I think, sometimes to some callers that we hear from, like the rules are inconsistent or random. How do you think about it at Hebrew Senior Life? And what is that balance between the freedom of movement of people to go out and the restriction of movement of people who want to come in?
Right. No, I fully understand the frustration, Marilyn, and I'm sorry that you're struggling with that, and you have good reason to. It is a very delicate balance. At Hebrew Senior Life, actually, for the last 2+ weeks, when things just started in Washington, we started being extremely proactive about restricting visitors and private aides. We initiated a program where we only allowed what we refer to as essential visitors. Essential in one category was people coming in an end-of-life situation, but we also are allowing aides to come in if they are providing essential services. So we do not allow aides to come in just because they're aides. We only allow them to come in if we feel as though they're providing services that are truly essential. We're very careful about trying to limit the number of aides that are coming in. We're very vigilant about the aide answering all the screening questions about travel and exposures, and we take their temperature, and then we have that aide only visiting with the person that they're helping, not any kind of congregate activities. We've restricted that totally. As far as the independent living residents we care for about 3,500 people on a daily basis in independent living in their homes and assisted living and nursing homes. And people who are in independent living, similar to what Governor Baker's done, strongly, strongly, strongly urge them to stay in their apartments and not congregate, and we do a ton of virtual entertainment engagement. But if they really want to go out, we cannot stop them from going out, but we do scrutinize significantly when they come back and ask them all the screening questions and make sure that they don't congregate with anybody else.
Lou, I appreciate it. I do want to break in there for a second because there's a piece of what you were saying that I want to focus in
sure.
on, which I know this was a hard decision and you've been taking these measures to help people stay safe. I want to bring Crystal in here and ask Crystal, what about the overall concern about social isolation among older adults and, you know, the accompanying concerns for overall mental and physical health with that isolation? How do you strike that balance?
What we've been doing at the Lathrop Home is we've been running activities, group activities with small groups under 10 on each floor. We have activity kits that we've actually been giving out to our residents. We've been setting them up with tray tables with their doors open so that the activity aides can work the hallway by going, you know, to different residents' rooms, but they're still able to maintain that 6 feet of social distancing from one another. Each resident at the Lathrop Home has a private room, so if they sit with their tray table at their doorway of their room, they can see other people. We play music, we stream live music, live entertainment. That's been something that they've really enjoyed, especially over the St. Patrick's Day holiday. They have told me that they believe that they are being very well taken care of and that we're not, you know, letting anybody in that can get them sick.
Yep, I appreciate that. And again, I'm sorry to sort of be interrupting you both, but I want to get a few questions to the two of you and make sure I've got at least one more call, too. So let me pivot back to Lou for just a second. And Lou, I do want to ask, how are families responding? Are they understanding these new restrictions?
Very much so. At the beginning, they thought perhaps we were being a little too vigilant when people weren't taking this quite as seriously. But as it's evolved, they have been incredibly appreciative and recognize why we did what we did so soon. We may have a handful of families who are feeling as though it's a little too restrictive, but that's a handful out of, you know, thousands of families. So they're being very, very, very appreciative.
Let's go back to calls. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Adam is on the line from Hudson, New Hampshire. Adam, go ahead.
Hey, how are you?
How are you, Adam? Good.
I'm calling. My family, we added to the care that my father was getting, and that greatly kept him alive for as long as he was. On Thursday, he passed away, unfortunately.
I'm sorry, Adam.
Only 2 days after, it is what it is, 2 days after the restrictions. So we can't help but feel like the crackdown and the lockdown really helped, keeping us away really kind of pushed him to the edge. So
Adam, are you saying that
he required a higher level of care?
Are you saying that he was in institutional care, you were supplementing that care, then you were not able to go, and he passed away after 2 days of you not being able to be there? I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, less than 48 hours. It's a lot of we're one case, but I think there's a lot of cases where the family's supplemental care really, you know, adds to it. Hygiene, things like that.
Okay, Adam, let me give that to our panelists. And again, I just want to say to you, I am really sorry for your loss, Adam. I really am. Crystal, what about the kinds of supports that family members were providing that they can't when they can't come into the facility?
We actually, we are allowing family members to come in at end of life. We have an individual who's currently on hospice, and what we do is we screen the family members and the hospice employees that are coming in the same way that we screen regular staff. They are required to gown up, so we put them in proper PPE with gloves. We watch them wash their hands. They have gloves, they have gowns on, they have face masks on. Then they can go and they visit with the resident that's receiving end-of-life care in their room, because that social isolation at end-of-life does speed up the death process, and we're wanting to make sure that the family gets to spend that time with the resident and the resident gets to receive that time with their family.
And Lou, Heber Senior Life is one of the largest providers in the state. I know you have one reported coronavirus case at the Satter Community in Revere. Can you give us details and what's happening there?
So, yes, we are. And we, as I said before, we have multiple levels of care. About 1,600 of the people we care for are in independent living, so it's separate from our health care services or our assisted living services. So the Jack Satter House is one of our affordable independent living communities. This is a very fluid situation, so we now have, as of today, actually two reported cases at the Jack Satter House, and they are both currently hospitalized, and we, you know, we wish them the best. But it is an independent living community, and we do the best we can to encourage them, as I've said, to stay in their apartments and all. But they do, you know, they do go out a bit, and it's so we do have those two cases.
And Crystal and Lou, and Crystal, I'll turn to you first. What is your advice or your thoughts for people who have loved ones who are older adults in care right now, and are feeling separated and worried?
I would. My advice would be to write letters, send emails, do FaceTime, send photographs with your letters and your stories. We are we're holding on to mail for 24 hours after we receive it, just to make sure that the residents aren't, you know, exposed to a live virus when receiving their mail. But we any emails that we receive to our resident email, we're printing those out daily with the photographs, giving them to the residents, and that really is the highlight of their day, to get a special message from their loved one, especially with photographs of their pets and things like that.
And Lou Wolf, how about you? What's your advice?
So first, I agree with everything Crystal said about doing what they can to augment the virtual engagement and company and all. What I would add to that is to really understand that the facility that is caring for your parents is absolutely doing the best they can, and they are in this, you know, for a reason. And to the extent that they are restricting visitors and all, respect that as much as possible. Support it as much as possible with your mom and dad, because that will be what does the best for them. And encourage the community to do as much as they can to do the kind of virtual engagement that Crystal talked about. You know, we have one thing, we just want to add one quick thing. We have a lot of employees who are working remotely because they're trying to keep everybody out. And we have employees that are repurposing, and they are doing the same thing with residents. They're calling them, they're sending them cards, they're coming in and helping feed them. So make sure the community is doing as much as they can to give one-on-one care and engagement to your mom and dad.
Oops, I lost you. I think we lost your last comment there, Lou.
Just to encourage the facility to do as much as they can to do one-on-one type engagement, because they, you know, they should be discouraging the congregate settings, but
they
can do more just to have one-on-one.
Excellent. That's Lou Wolf, President and CEO of Hebrew Senior Life. Thanks, Lou.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And Crystal Cote-Stowes, Administrative Director of Lathrop Home. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
We continue today to take your calls and questions on the coronavirus with area health experts. What do you want to know? What questions do you have? Where do you need clarification? What are your concerns? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or tweet us at Radio Boston. With us on the line today, returning, is Dr. Helen Boucher, Chief of the Division of Geographic Medicine and Infectious Diseases at Tufts Medical Center. She's also Treasurer of the Infectious Diseases Society of America. Thanks for being with us again, Dr. Boucher.
Thank you so much for having me.
And also with us today is Julia Marcus, an infectious disease epidemiologist and assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. Welcome to Radio Boston, Julia.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to ask, as people, I think anxiety is dialing up, and as our callers begin to call in, let me ask Dr. Boucher, what would a course of symptoms look like for a person who may wonder if they just have a runny nose or if they are experiencing the coronavirus?
Oh, that's a great question, Tiziana, and I agree wholeheartedly that tensions are running high the last few days. The symptoms of the COVID virus are often similar to a common cold. And if you have those type of symptoms, it's really important that you stay home and take care of yourself. What we want to hear from you is when you have worsening symptoms, like a worse cough, a fever that's persistent, chest pain, difficulty breathing, those type of things would bring you to the hospital. We also see some patients who have stomach symptoms, and there's been a little news the past few days about a funny sense of taste or smell, and many people also have muscle aches.
And how different is that from the flu?
You know, it's really often not that different from the flu. This is a flu-like illness, but I think one thing that's, it is different from seasonal allergies. It's different from a simple cold often. Most of the people that we've seen feel crummy, and they're pretty clear that they feel crummy.
And Julia Marcus, I had a listener write me earlier today and say, so often people say, if you're experiencing X, then call your doctor. What if you don't have a doctor? Who do you call?
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends where you are, but the CDC has resources in terms of who to contact. And certainly if you're having trouble breathing, I would recommend calling 911. That would definitely constitute an emergency situation.
Let's start taking some calls. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jan is on the line from Provincetown. Hello, Jan.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Yes, I've been getting information from others, either via text or Facebook. I don't listen to Facebook much. But the question I have is, they're sending out information that if we drink hot liquids, if we drink hot water, if we drink hot tea, if we drink anything really hot, that will help protect us, and not to drink anything cold. So I'm having a hard time with understanding that that could be accurate, but I'm not a doctor.
Well, let's find out, because Helen Boucher is a doctor. So, Dr. Boucher, what's your response to what Jan's been reading or hearing on social media?
Yeah, you know, I'm not familiar with those data, so I'm not aware that there's any benefit to drinking particularly hot versus cold liquids. So I think it's important to stay hydrated and well-nourished, but I'm not aware of any information about the temperature of what you drink.
And Julia Marcus, as an infectious disease expert, it must be familiar to you to hear people saying, I'm trying to figure out what to believe in the information I'm reading on the internet. What's your advice for people today when, in fact, they are secluded and most of their information is coming at them through their social media channels and through the internet?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's a lot of misinformation out there. And the problem with social media, a great thing about it is that it's a great source of good information, but it can also very quickly spread misinformation. And so in terms of understanding ways to protect ourselves from infection, our best source of information right now is the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So go to cdc.gov and trust what information you find there, and question your sources when you're reading information on social media. Make sure that somebody is at least has some expertise in the area, and again, CDC is really your best source of information right now.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dean is on the line from Brookline. Dean, go ahead.
Hi. I was inspired, not by the president, of course, but by other politicians like Bernie Sanders saying, what can we do to help as citizens? And I have a CPAP machine, which, you know, is used to help you breathe. It provides air at night. And I'm wondering if people should be donating those since there's a ventilator shortage. Is that kind of machine something that can, in a pinch, as a backup, help at all?
Okay, thanks for that question, Dean. Dr. Boucher, is it possible to repurpose something like a CPAP machine in a ventilator shortage?
Well, that's such a great question, and it's so heartwarming, really, that you're willing to give up your own therapy for somebody else. The information that we have so far doesn't suggest that a CPAP machine would be able to, you know, serve the purpose of a ventilator. What's called a BiPAP machine might, and there are calls for equipment in many hospitals, and also MassBio are collecting a variety of equipment. So if you had other equipment that you were interested in donating, or any of the personal protective equipment that we need, that would be so much appreciated. Thank you so much.
And I do want to ask you and follow up, Dr. Boucher. We heard some interesting exchanges just today, for example, with New York Governor Andrew Cuomo about availability of ventilators. He was responding to FEMA, who offered to send some, saying, that's not enough. How concerned are you about the supply or availability of ventilators in our healthcare facilities here in the Commonwealth?
Well, I think we're all concerned about the supply of a number of precious resources, and ventilators are one of those. And that's really the reason that we've been so, loud in the message of the importance of all these mitigation measures like social distancing and all the things that are disrupting our lives right now. The purpose of doing all this is so that the healthcare system doesn't become overwhelmed with the number of patients all at once who need things like ventilators. So we are all planning for the ability to care for as many patients as once as we can, but we're really emphasizing, and I want to make sure the listeners understand the importance of sticking with this program of social distancing and all the other disruptive things that are happening in our lives to help prevent us from getting to the situation where we're overwhelmed in the need for things like ventilators.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jennifer from Cambridge. Hi, Jennifer.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
My call is kind of two-part, but it just is about the process of, like, when we do go out for fresh air and we come home, is the mail a risk? And am I supposed to take off my clothes and shoes and wash them and take a shower?
Great questions, Jennifer. Julia Marcus, what do we know about the level of sort of wash and self-protection at home that people need to practice?
That is a great question. As far as we know, the most likely way to become infected is by close contact with somebody who's infected. So just going out on a walk and not touching anything and not coming within 6 feet of anybody is really, you know, you're not really at risk in that situation. In terms of your question around mail and bringing anything into your house, like a package or grocery delivery, again, it's fairly low risk, but in that case, it is possible that if somebody were sick and were delivering a package to you and had just sneezed on their hands and picked up the package and then you grabbed it, you know, it's within the realm of possibility that you could, there could be transmission in that situation. But I think the best thing to do is anytime you bring anything new into your house, or if you go outside and you actually touch things or interact with people, definitely wash your hands and try not to touch your face and kind of use those same precautions that you normally would. But I do think just going out on a walk is, you're really not at risk.
Let's go to Judith now in Dover, New Hampshire. Hello, Judith.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call.
Yes, please.
Okay. Yes. Okay. So my husband is a travel nurse and he's working at Portsmouth Hospital right now. There are some virus cases there. He has underlying conditions. I am concerned about the equipment and stuff they have at the hospital. But also, I am concerned about people who have fibromyalgia, lupus, multiple sclerosis, things like that. And I can't find anything on the internet about stuff like that.
Dr. Boucher, any thoughts for Judith?
Well, so Judith, I think that, you know, we're still learning a lot about this virus, but we know from the experience in other countries that people with underlying conditions and people who are over 60 seem to be more at risk of having complications and more difficulty with managing this infection. So, you know, in those people, we want to be extra vigilant in terms of all of our preventative measures. And your husband, who's a nurse, is well-versed on the importance of things like washing his hands and using the protective equipment appropriately. And so I think, you know, just vigilance with that is the most important thing for him. And for other people not working in healthcare, following the mitigation measures like social distancing, and those things are the most important measures they can take to protect themselves from the virus.
1-800-423-8255 to join the conversation here. That's 1-800-423-TALK to ask questions of our panel of medical experts. Dave is on the line from Dedham. Dave, go ahead.
Hi. You know, the WHO this morning said that the cases of coronavirus in the United States has risen a lot more than anywhere else in the world. Is that more a matter that we're testing a lot more and the people we're really testing are probably already sick because that's one of the criteria for testing people? And is that the number we should be looking at, total number of cases, or should we be looking at instead number of people hospitalized or number of people who have died as a better indicator of what's going on as far as when it might be safe to go back into the water?
Great questions, Dave. Let's turn to Julia Marcus.
That is a great question. There is so much we don't know because we're not testing widely. So you really bring up a great point that just looking at the number of diagnosed cases or the number who have been hospitalized or the number of deaths doesn't really give us that denominator, the number of people who've been tested. And testing also varies by state. by jurisdiction and certainly by country. So it's pretty hard to compare across countries or states or cities. And as testing increases, and then in some cases, like in New York, is kind of slowing down or at least being focused in healthcare settings, the number of cases is going to vary based on that. And so to try to answer your question, you know, we need to kind of take all of these data points into consideration, but I think we still have a lot more to learn about the kind of global epidemiology of what's happening right now.
Mary's on the line from Marshfield. Mary, go ahead.
Well, I just have a question. I don't hear anybody talking about all the vape users and cigarette smokers or tobacco users or even marijuana users. I would think that they might be more at risk.
So let's ask Dr. Boucher that. Thanks, Mary. Dr. Yes. Boucher.
Yeah, it's a great point, Mary. And we know from the epidemic in China, the data that we have coming out of China, that people who smoked did more poorly with the virus. So I think it's very rational to be concerned about the lungs of people who vape and smoke, for sure. And we're going to learn more about the face of the epidemic here in the United States with those habits as we understand more. But it's a very reasonable concern.
Julia Marcus, I want to turn to you a question that came up earlier today after Governor Charlie Baker talked about the need to flatten the curve and practice social distancing, just really to make sure we don't overwhelm our hospital system. Is social distancing and our need to practice it at a large scale right now directly related to our ability to handle a surge of patients? And if we have a scaled up healthcare system, will social distancing become less necessary, or are they, you know, sort of both parts of a value chain that both have to be in place?
Yeah, that's kind of a million-dollar question right now. I think it's absolutely clear that social distancing is needed right now to mitigate that surge on the healthcare system that you're talking about. I think it's a little less clear how we're going to come out of this and when. And certainly we need to focus on not just flattening the curve, but people are also starting to talk about raising the bar or raising the capacity of the healthcare system to handle larger numbers of patients. So I think over the next weeks and months, we're going to have to think carefully about how to kind of re-enter society and whether that's going to be staged with younger people starting to go back to work first. I think we really need to think about those public health measures and be increasing the capacity of the healthcare system at the same time.
So, Dr. Boucher, we don't have time to go to another caller, but we did have a caller who wanted to know how concerned they should be about the toxicity of products that are being recommended as being effective for home cleaning, things with bleach and other chemicals in them.
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, one thing that the CDC has been very clear about is that the standard products that we use to clean are effective against this virus. So I don't think you need to go more crazy than you usually do about cleaning. You just might want to do it more often. And to harken back to your earlier question, we also know from the CDC that washing your clothes in the usual way you wash your clothes in the washing machine is fine for your clothes should they have been affected by the virus as well.
All right. Dr. Helen Boucher of Tufts Medical Center and Julia Marcus of the Harvard Medical School, thanks to both of you. I appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.